WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have several interviews for you, one on how we can construct simple rules by which to live more successful lives. We'll also take a brief look at the history of one of the most interesting states in the Union, Texas, and about the Texas Revolution, which liberated Texans from Mexico, and the rise of the famous Texas Rangers. That and more coming up on today's morning show here on WGTD. Most of us need no reminder whatsoever that we live in a complicated world, and a complicated world which seems to be growing more complex by the day. And not only is the world complex, but we are also aware of its complexities in an ever-escalating way thanks to modern technology. How is one to make sense of it? How is one to craft a plan of success in an increasingly complicated world? One solution lies within a very, very interesting book called Simple Rules, How to Thrive in a Complex World. The co-authors of this book, Kathleen Eisenhart, and my morning show guest, Donald Saul, have crafted a very intriguing concept, in a sense not utterly out of their own originality and creativity, but by observing the world and observing certain compelling success stories. And they have managed to sort of cull together some guiding principles on how one can live successfully and operate professionally successfully in this complicated world by adhering to simple rules that one creates versus trying to combat the complex problems of life and the world with complicated solutions. It really is a book that gives us lots of food for thought. And I'm excited to speak with one of the authors, Donald Saul, who is a senior lecturer at the MIT Sloan School of Management and once a professor at Harvard and the London Business School. And this book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Donald Saul, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
I appreciate how the book begins in fairly dramatic fashion, actually. The introduction actually takes us to war-torn Iraq. And tell us the scene which you paint here and why you think, and I agree, it serves as a very good introduction to the topic of simple rules.
Right. So we start the book talking about an Army medic, a guy named Sergeant Montoya, who is in line for dinner around the holiday time, and is unfortunately is there when an explosive goes off, and suddenly the scene is chaos. There are bodies everywhere, smoke, noise, confusion, and the challenge Montoya faces as a highly trained Army medic is how to quickly prioritize patients for care, right? Some patients, unfortunately, are just going to, some of the injured soldiers are just going to have to tough it out. Some need immediate care, however. How do they do that? And you can imagine a very complicated solution to this, a long checklist, for instance. Instead, what's emerged in combat medicine, as well as emergency room medicine around the world, is a system called triage, where medics like Sergeant Montoya quickly use a couple of simple rules in terms of blood pressure and responsiveness and so forth, and quickly, spending typically 20, 30 seconds per patient, assess the severity of the injuries and sort them into one of three categories. Those injured that'll be fine, they can afford to wait. Those that unfortunately are beyond saving. And then the third category, which is those that only with intervention can be saved, and those are the ones that are prioritized for medical care. So the point we try to make with this is, even in a very complex, quickly evolving, uncertain situation, when time and pressure are, time is of the essence, and you're under a great deal of pressure, simple rules can be a powerful tool for making decisions and acting.
Hmm. And I really appreciate the way that you lay out then the advantages that come from utilization of simple rules, which is something that a lot of us do all of the time without really thinking about it. And a couple of these advantages I really think are worth exploring and lifting up. One of the things you say is simple rules allow people to act without having to stop and rethink every decision. And of course, when one thinks about the opposite, if every decision we make is going to be based on weighing every possible alternative and made only through the most laborious of processes, one ends up never making a decision at all. And there are some people who are cursed to live their lives like that.
Right. And yeah, so the clear benefit of simple rules, like the case of the Army medic, illustrates, is it allows people to make very rapid decisions under a lot of pressure with limited time and limited information, and avoid exactly, Greg, as you're pointing out, this risk of analysis paralysis. I guess the surprising benefit to us around the decision-making element of simple rules is that oftentimes simple rules can outperform more complicated models, independent of the fact they're quicker, independent of the fact they use less data. So we talk in the book, for instance, about a simple rule known as the 1 over N rule for allocating assets, which basically says if you have 10 asset classes, each of them gets 10%. If you have 20, each of them gets 5%. And there's been a very interesting series of studies done by financial economists that have compared this simple rule to the most, you know, kind of state-of-the-art asset allocation models, including a series of models that are based on the work of Harry Markowitz, who went on to win the Nobel Prize in economics for his work. And what's interesting is that simple rule, the 1 over N rule, outperforms in a series of tests in real-world data, outperforms these more sophisticated models 80% of the time while never losing investors' money. In contrast, these very sophisticated models, only won 20% of the time and lost money for their investors about half the time. All of this is before fees, by the way. So the surprising thing is not just that simple rules are quick and efficient and that you can use them without a lot of data. Sometimes they actually outperform more complex models. Actually, interestingly, Markowitz admitted to a Wall Street Journal reporter years after he won the Nobel Prize that when it came to allocating his own funds for his retirement investments, he used the 1 over N rule. So even the founder of the sophisticated model sometimes relied on the simpler rule.
Right. One of the most intriguing decisions you and your co-author make in crafting this book and in supporting the points you make, substantiating the points you make with real-life examples, is that those real-life examples emerge not only from sort of the human realm, particularly that of business, I mean, somebody like Steve Jobs, but you also end up talking about honeybees and crickets and geese and examples from the animal kingdom of, in a sense, simple rules which play out in a very similar sort of fashion. I'm very intrigued and ultimately really glad you did that, but it strikes me as kind of a risky thing to do, because I think at a glance it seems like you're talking about two very different things. The way the bees in a honey in a colony of bees operate, and the way, you know, a company like Apple operates, those seem like they're two different phenomena. What do you see as the connection there that makes that a valid comparison to make?
Yeah, so the first thing, our point in this book, we've been working on this for almost 15 years, and what we tried to do was study simple rules across a variety of domains. So business and entrepreneurship that we know well, innovation, creativity, monetary policy, and as you mentioned, social biology, and tried to understand why, what were the elements that made simple rules so effective across so many different domains. And we found, indeed, that some of these cross-cutting elements did cut across not just business into the arts, for instance, but into the animal kingdom as well. And I'll just explain two of the benefits that the reason I think we find simple rules working is that we face similar problems. So animals or insects or birds, like people, have to make quick choices on limited information. So crickets, female crickets, for instance, face a very difficult choice, which is when do they stop looking for Mr. Right and settle for Mr. Good Enough? And that's a challenge like the decision challenge that many of us face when we're sorting through songs on the radio, for instance, trying to decide where to settle down or decide where to live or what career to settle down on. This is the sequential choice is a common decision situation that human beings find themselves as well as insects. And in the case of the female crickets, they use a rule which is they favor a male cricket with a certain chirp rate. The faster they chirp, the more virile they are in the cricket world. But they have a second rule, which is if you don't hear a quick chirping cricket within a period of time, typically 6 to 8 hours, then you settle for the next the next cricket you find. So this is the problem that female crickets face is like a decision problem that human beings face a lot of the time, and in that domain, as in the human domain, the benefit of simple rules is that they can help you to make a good decision with limited information, with limited time. So I think because the problems they face are similar, it's not surprising actually that simple rules are applied across different domains.
We're speaking with Donald Sull, and we're talking about his very intriguing book called Simple Rules: How to Thrive in a Complex World. You and your co-author lay out four guiding principles which help explain why simple rules work so effectively across so many different domains. And the first one, in some ways, seems fairly obvious, and yet the reason why this is important, I think, is not entirely obvious. And that is that the number of rules matter, that by their very nature, when one is living a life or running a business via simple rules, you have just a few rules. That there's, in a sense, no such thing as a list of 100 simple rules for your life or for your company. There have to be a few rules. But why is that so important?
Yeah, so the obvious reason, as you point out, is that people remember a small handful of rules. So many of us will have learned at some point in our education this notion of 7 ±2. And the idea was human beings were wired to remember 5 to 9 items in a similar category without prompting. It turns out that's wrong. We're actually wired to remember 4 ±1. That is to say, literally a handful of rules or anything really are what we're wired to remember. So one, it's really easy to remember that, and that matters a lot in the heat of action. So if we think back to the medic, where people are screaming, there's smoke, it's not clear if another attack is coming. You know, unless you have a simple set of rules, it's very hard to remember them in the heat of the moment and in action. The other benefits of a small number are a little more subtle and a little less intuitive. The second one is the need to communicate. So oftentimes the benefit of rules comes from their use, not by a single individual, but by a community of people. So Zipcar, for instance, car sharing company, when Robin Chase and her co-founder founded the company in the year 2000, they could have come up with a thick rule manual for all of the users as to, dictating you must do this, thou shalt do that, thou shalt not do that, which nobody would have read, let alone remembered. Instead, what they did was they came up with a set of 6 rules, pets in containers, no smoking, filler up, that were easy to communicate to members and reduced about 90-95% of all the conflicts between members. So a small number, easy to communicate, which matters a lot when you have a community using the rules. The final benefit is probably the least obvious. It forces prioritization. So the temptation is always with rules to say, oh, here's another contingency, let's throw out another rule, even though it's a very rare contingency. Here's another contingency, let's throw out another rule. And that's how rules become proliferate and become cumbersome and bureaucratic and lead to rigidity. So by capping the number of rules, you force a prioritization on what are the things that matter most. And then you also, as a result of that prioritization, leave scope for judgment, initiative, expertise, creativity on the part of the users of the rules. So the number matters a lot.
Right. As does the fact that they are tailored to particular situations and or the particular people that use them. So, for instance, the guiding principles for just a regular person in terms of what they should eat. You give the example of author Michael Pollan, who spells out three very simple rules that can guide the ordinary person's dietary choices. And yet, if the person in question is a linebacker at USC, then they need to be adhering to a different array of simple rules about the very same matter. So one does not want to construct simple rules that supposedly apply to the whole universe or to every situation. That defeats the purpose.
Oh, it's a critical point, because I think a lot of people will try to sell you their rules. And the assumption is it's one size fits all, or you can take the rules off the shelf and they'll work. And you know, this is one of the most robust findings from our research, is that's rarely the case. So the diet case, yeah, Michael Pollan has good general rules for people who are trying to achieve health. You know, the Stanford strength coach had a set of rules for, you know, boys who weigh 250, 300 pounds and are, you know, burning a lot of calories. But so they're tailored, and which brings us to a second point, which is really critical. The process of how you develop your rules is as important as the rules themselves. And I'll just, sticking on this diet theme, I'll tell you about my own experience with simple rules. I use them all the time. And one of the things, about a year and a half ago, I decided I need to lose about 15 pounds to fit into my shirts, which were feeling a bit too tight. And so I went through the three steps that we advocate you should go through to develop rules that are tailored to your use. So the first one is understanding what your objective is. In that case, it was pretty straightforward. The second is identifying what we call a bottleneck, a critical activity or decision that influences your ability to achieve your objectives. Now, you might say that's obvious. If you're losing weight, you know, it's around what you eat or how much you exercise. Well, what we argue is it's better to go with a more specific bottleneck. So what I did for a week, I got one of these apps to track what I ate and where I exercised. And what I discovered was pretty interesting, that, you know, during the day my diet was okay, but after dinner all hell broke loose. You know, and when Ben and Jerry's and, you know, a bottle of Cabernet were calling out my name, and I was eating the equivalent of one or two lunches every day after dinner. So the bottleneck then was, rather than all exercise and diet or movement, it was very specific after-dinner snacking. And that matters, because it turns out willpower is a reservoir, not a river. We tend to deplete it throughout the course of the day. So by limiting the amount of time where I had to apply simple rules, I reduced the amount of willpower necessary to follow those rules. So that was the selection of the bottleneck. And the third point is developing the rules that are right for you. And again, it's not taking somebody else's rules, copying somebody else's rules that may or may not work for you. And you can get them from multiple sources. So I did some online research and discovered the single biggest driver of weight gain or loss in adults is portion size. Okay, so I had a rule that I'd eat chips out of a bowl rather than out of a bag. You know, another thing was talking to my wife, and she said, look, if you buy a box of Snickers bars, you're going to eat a box of Snickers bars. If there's only one Snicker bar, you can only eat one. So that led to another rule, which was no stockpiling snacks and so forth. So the rules came from different sources, but they were tailored to my specific situation, and they were my rules. And in that case, they were. I lost the 15 pounds I need, and now the shirts fit, so I'm pretty happy about that.
You also say that a guiding principle is that these simple rules need to be concrete but not overly prescriptive. That is, if they are too specific, too restrictive, then they're not going to function as well. They're not going to be quite flexible enough to be workable for all of the specific variations that life throws at us.
Yeah, and so what we're arguing is that simple rules should be a framework for discussion and decisions, not an algorithm. By which we mean this: you should not be sticking data in and the correct answer pops out, quote unquote. Instead, what you want to do is provide some guidance, but leave scope for flexibility, for creativity, for innovation, for judgment, for people to exercise their expertise and respond to local circumstances. This is a really critical element, that the rules provide guidance but leave that scope for judgment and expertise. Now, you don't want to go to the other extreme and have them be so vague that they're irrelevant. So, you know, one of the companies that I studied looked, actually two companies, were two banks competing in Russia right after the introduction of capitalism. Both banks decided to use simple rules to screen investment alternatives. And one bank had rules that were so vague that they were useless. You know, invest in undervalued companies, prefer companies with potential for growth. Well, you know, these things are obvious. They provide no guidance, and as a result, the investment professionals ignored them. Another bank, in contrast, had rules that were very concrete. So, for instance, they said a business has to have at least $100 million in revenues but less than $500 million. Okay, that clarified this is the range we're looking at. Another rule for that bank was if a typical family had an extra $100 per month in disposable income, would they be likely to spend it on this service or good? Okay, that, again, it didn't tell you yes or no, but it provided a framework for the discussion and the evaluation of the opportunity and allowed, so provided clear guidance and was concrete, but still left some scope for judgment and initiative, which is, of course, what you want from people.
Hmm. In the several minutes that remain to us, I should probably give you an opportunity to sketch out a list of six types of simple rules that can be very important, again, not only in one's professional life, but in one's personal life as well. And then we'll leave it to our listeners to explore these in greater detail on their own.
Yeah, so one of the things that we noted in studying rules across these different domains is that although the variety of rules is stunning, you know, the rules Tina Fey uses to produce 30 Rock versus the rules honeybees use to find a nest versus the rules that mountaineers use when climbing, very different rules. What was interesting is they fell into six broad categories, and three of them have to do with decision-making. So the first type of rule we talk about are boundary rules. So these are something is in or out. So, for instance, the co-founders of Miramax Films used a set of rules to decide which screenplays they'd look at or not. I mean, if you're a producer of a film company, it turns out everybody and their brother and sister are handing you screenplays all the time. So these were rules like deal with a common human emotion like envy or pride, have an attractive but fundamentally flawed protagonist. So they had a set of rules that very quickly allowed them to say, nope, 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 yep, this is one worth looking at. A second set of rules is around prioritization. So how do we decide where we allocate scarce resources? And, you know, a couple of examples we talked about, scarce medical resources, the triage rules in frontline healthcare, for instance, or the 1/n rule for allocating resources across different asset classes. So this is a very common type of rule. The third type of decision rule is what we call stopping rules. And stopping rules, as the name suggests, tell you when to stop doing something rather than when to what to start doing. And one of the most famous examples of stopping rules is known as the 2 o'clock rule, a rule that climbers ascending Everest would follow. That is to say, if they hadn't hit the summit by 2 p.m., they would turn around regardless. And this rule helped them, despite all the pressure to try to hit the summit, which they, of course, wanted to do, reminded them of the dangers of proceeding beyond that period. The other three types of rules are not so much about what you do and more about how you do it. So the how-to rules are rules that tell you about how best to do a process. So one of the stories we tell about in the book is when I was in college, I worked my way through college as a bouncer in a biker bar. And I quickly realized that a pure brawn strategy wouldn't work, so came up with a set of simple rules for that process. The most useful of which was keep the bikers on side. So when a rumble was about to break out, I'd go and get one or two of the bikers to accompany me over to escort the folks out the door. So how-to rules. The second type of process rules are around coordination rules. So it turns out, for instance, birds in flight follow a set of simple rules that allow them to coordinate with one another while adjusting to changing circumstances. And it turns out these rules are very simple. Fly in the same direction, don't bump into each other, and don't get too far away. But by following those rules, we can explain and understand this magnificent emergent flocking behavior in birds. And then the final kind type of rules, what we call timing rules. So when you start doing things, how you link the timing of activities to external circumstances. So one of my favorite examples of this is from a Brazilian conglomerate that's done extremely well over the past 100 years. And their rule for timing their investment is buy when the gringos are selling and sell when the gringos are buying. And it turns out that rule has worked pretty well for them over the past 100 years.
Your book, as I said, gives us a lot to think about the way we tend to make such choices and decisions in our personal lives and, of course, in the professional sphere, whatever that might be for us. This book also serves up a lot of important and thoughtfully crafted information and suggestions for living better in a complicated world. The book, again, is called Simple Rules, How to Thrive in a Complex World, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Donald Suhl, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
And it's 8:35. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. Part three will be a rebroadcast of the conversation which I recorded late last week with Racine native son David Kurdian, a very highly regarded best-selling author who is back in town all this week with a number of different personal appearances. Here's part two of The Morning Show on WGTD. And now for a conversation that takes us into a different part of the country. And it's a part of the country that I don't know as well as I should, nor do I know its fascinating history as well as I should. But that is corrected to some extent through a wonderful book, which is a companion book to what promises to be a superb mini-series about to air on the History Channel. A program called and a book called Texas Rising: The Epic True Story of the Lone Star Republic and the Rise of the Texas Rangers, 1836 to 1846. The author of this fascinating book is Stephen Moore, who is now the sixth generation of Texas, and someone who actually can count among his ancestors actual Texas Rangers. His great-great-great-grandfather was one of the first Texas Ranger captains in the 1830s. So Stephen Moore comes at this fascinating topic with more than a little personal interest, as well as, of course, intense interest as a Texan and a historian. And perhaps you have encountered before this 18 Minutes, The Battle of San Jacinto and the Texas Independence Campaign, the four-volume Savage Frontier series, which talked also about the early Texas Rangers. And a book called Taming Texas. Again, this latest one is called Texas Rising. It's published by William Morrow and bears the imprint of the History Channel. Stephen Moore, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I guess I had, as a Iowan and Wisconsinite, a sort of a glancing, vague notion of Texas's fascinating and colorful history. But not until I took your book in hand did I come to really fully appreciate just what a colorful past it has had, which in many respects helps explain its colorful present. Why don't we begin with, in a sense, the beleaguered state of those who lived within the borders of Texas? What led to the formation of what was known as the Texas Rangers? What was the state of affairs, the daily life like, which necessitated the creation of the Texas Rangers?
Well, the early settlers that Stephen F. Austin and some of the other impresarios brought into Texas had to abide by Mexican rule and, you know, be good Catholics and live a certain way of life. And things were fairly amenable for a number of years. But President Santa Anna, when he came into power, he eventually changed his style of government there and threw out the Constitution that had been in place since 1824 and basically established a virtual dictatorship. And so things that the settlers had come to know and appreciate were gone. By 1835, he's moving troops into Texas to enforce tariffs and to kind of hold people against their will to do things his way. It led to friction. It led to some revolts and some uprisings, and eventually to the revolution that broke out in October of 1835.
Tell us also about the presence of the Comanches, which also really created a different kind of peril, equally dangerous.
There were the Comanches, the Cherokees, and a number of tribes in Texas. Some of them had been fairly peaceful with the settlers. Others had created raids and depredations and killings on the farms. During the Revolution, they were kind of mixed on their loyalties to attack the settlers or to allow the Mexicans to play out the Revolution. After the Texas Revolution passes, the Indians become the major focus for the Rangers and for the Army in Texas to keep them controlled, or in the case of President Lamar, his desire was to move them out of Texas. So as you can imagine, quite a few battles and campaigns ensue with the Comanches and some of the other more hostile tribes that lived there.
There are a number of different events that sort of precipitate the events that are the main focus of this miniseries and your book. Among them, something I'd never heard of before, the 1826 Fredonian Rebellion. Just give us a brief idea of what this was like and why it was one of many catalysts that would spark the tension you were talking about earlier.
There were a number of catalysts like that. I mean, that took place in the oldest town in Texas, Nacogdoches, where, incidentally, I went to school there. So I've got a lot of appreciation for the history of all those eras. But you had some of the early leaders that were taking part in some of those revolts, the Fredonian Revolt, the Anahuac disturbances. Travis was one of the other early names that took part in some of the revolts, and he, of course, becomes the commander of the Alamo compound. Excuse me. But those little incidents like that are little pieces to the puzzle that over a number of years led to what was the final spark of the Revolution.
At one point in your book, you say the roots of the Texas Rangers can be traced to both Spanish, Mexican, and Anglo influences. In what way?
They had, in the Spanish era, light cavalry companies that would fly across the borders and through the frontiers, mobile, small numbers that could move quickly to take care of disturbances or problems. And the Rangers, as they were created, served the same fashion. My ancestor had a region between two rivers in Texas that was vast and enormous, but with 10 men, they're expected to cover all those frontiers, all those farms, and take on Indian tribes or Mexican troops or whatever they might encounter. So they had to be strike fast, move quick, and get out of danger and report what they had seen. So that kind of concept went back to some of the early ranging type companies in the U.S., which were early of British origin, that type of fighting.
Among the most important names in this era is that of General Sam Houston. Tell us why he was, in a sense, a somewhat controversial, maybe even divisive figure, although in some respects also, without a doubt, one of the great heroes of this era. But a hero with, let's say, a few blemishes on his reputation. Is that a good way to say it?
That's a pretty good way to say it. He was a hero of fighting with Andrew Jackson back in the War of 1812 and some of the key battles there with the Indians. And, you know, he later became a well-known politician, you know, governor of the state of Tennessee. But he had his troubles in business and in politics. He was broken a couple of times to where he would kind of fall back with his Cherokee family and live with them for a number of years. Had some issues with drinking, as has been documented, and eventually makes his way to Texas, as do some others, to kind of make a fresh start. You know, here's a chance to really make his star shine again, perhaps become a key politician in that state or become a leader. And, of course, as Texas declares its independence in March of 1836, he's voted to the top command, the commanding general of the Army and the Rangers and all the volunteers. So he has his chance. And in due time, he makes the most of that chance and, as we know, eventually rises to become president of the Republic of Texas.
As we learn about the Texas Revolution, and again, it's something that I think a lot of us in the North just don't know nearly enough about, we hear the Alamo in San Antonio. Remember the Alamo. But it sounds like just as fervent a battle cry back then would have been, do we pronounce it Goliad?
Goliad, yes. There was another commander there by the name of Fannin, and Houston had tried to get him to take his troops to go to San Antonio to help defend the Alamo. for a variety of reasons. Fannin never does. He holds out with his men down there, and they are eventually confronted by Mexican troops and have their own battle. And by the time the night is over, the next morning, he's forced to surrender his men under what he hopes will be peaceful terms. They are marched back into the compound there at Goliad, and Santa Anna declares anyone rising up against him in Texas to be treated as pirates and as such be put to death. So all the Texans are marched out before firing squads and executed at point-blank range. About 28 of them do survive, either stabbed or shot, to swim the river and escape to safety. And when word of those survivors makes it to Sam Houston's army, you definitely have a new battle cry, not just remember the Alamo, but remember Goliad and all the men that were executed there by Santa Anna.
Hmm. How much did the result of this Texas Revolution hang in the balance? That is, how close did the Texans come to going down to defeat against an army which in many respects was larger and better equipped? And what ultimately made the difference and secured them victory?
Well, there was one skirmish on April 20th with cannon and cavalry, but it was indecisive by the end of the day. The next day, April 21st, we finally get to the main battle late in the afternoon, and Sam Houston's officers decide, let's hold off and let's wait and see what they do. The Mexican army never advances, so late afternoon, the Texans storm across the field silently and catch the Mexican army literally sleeping, taking siestas. Their horses have been turned loose to graze. No one's prepared for the assault that hits their camp. And so they're badly surprised and overtaken within the first 18 minutes. And thereafter, for the next couple of hours, it becomes a vengeful slaughter, as people who remember the Alamo and remember Goliad have no intentions of taking any prisoners. Ironically, even in spite of the slaughter that ensues, Santa Anna escapes the battlefield, and it very well could have ended differently had the Texans not tracked him down and captured him the next day.
Hmm. Well, we can read about that and more in your fascinating book called Texas Rising, and we can view the miniseries on the History Channel, which debuts on the 25th, Memorial Day. Stephen L. Moore, thank you so much for this good work, and best wishes to you.
Thank you, sir.
For part three of today's morning show, I want to rebroadcast for you the interview which I recorded late last week with Racine native son David Curdian, a highly regarded author who is in town, in his hometown this week, for a number of different public appearances in which the public has a chance to meet him and hear from him. And at the end of this hour, we will give a full rundown of the events which are remaining in David Curdian's visit to Racine. So here's a portion of that conversation, again recorded last Friday. Good to be talking with you. How often is it that you get back to Racine? When is the last time you were here?
I think 2008 I got the Emily Lee Award. And came back for that. That was the last time. Mm.
So you were born in 1931. What are the most significant recollections you have of growing up in Racine?
I've written about all of them, so I have to kind of remember myself. Well, you know, it was the town it was. You know, it was a factory town, and it was full of noises and sounds and smells, and it was very simple. We were all rather poor, but we never thought of ourselves as being poor because we were all in the same boat. But as a result of that, we were very inventive, we were very creative, and we were close to one another. It was a very strong sense of family, and I think people who have left Racine, and most of them leave, actually, have this great endearing feeling of having once been contained in a wonderful place.
Tell us about your Armenian heritage and to what extent that was a significant shaper of who you grew up to be.
Yeah, well, I think your first generation, you're straddling two cultures, and so you're growing up being hyphenated, and the Armenian part of it is very strong in the beginning and becomes less so as you become more and more yourself, not just necessarily more and more American, just more and more yourself. And so my heritage has been extremely important to me, and I've explored it at great depth. I recently retold a ninth century Armenian epic called David of Sassoon, for example. So it's been a part of my identity, an important part and less important as an aspect of my identity. I'm not at least bit chauvinistic. I believe for a human being, the most important thing is to create your own individuality. And that is what I've worked for. I'm a deeply spiritual person, but I'm not interested in religions. So that creates a conflict in some people's minds.
Tell us about your extraordinary mother, and in particular, what it was like for you as her son to tell her particular story, a story filled with such pain, of course.
My mother was an incredible woman, just an astonishing woman. Imagine she survived alone out of an entire family. And what it did for her, however, was create a tremendously strong character full of sympathy and love and compassion for other people. So one of my earliest memories were she would take me visiting to old people who had gone through the massacres, who were alone and bereft, and she would comfort them. And when the DPs started coming here, she would have her over to the home. She would buy their stuff. She would feed them. What it brought out in her was the best in her. And so it was a great privilege to be her son. Of course, I didn't have value these things when I was growing up. And I was annoyed by the fact that we had this huge burden that no one seemed able to lift. And at one point, at the age of 17, I just had this vision that I would have to do something extraordinary with my life to balance the great losses that my people had suffered. You couldn't correct that. You couldn't change that. You couldn't undo it. But what you could do was make a life that was so special that somehow, this is a child thinking, but it's not a child thought. How can I balance the errors of the world? Because you do think that big when you're a kid. You eventually end up compromising your values over time because of the pressures of society. But that was a vision I had, and I retained it. I lost it and regained it over a lifetime. But I have made something of my life that I don't think it balances out what the losses were. But I did not live an ordinary life. I lived for me a very special life, and I feel privileged and grateful that I've had the life I've had.
Talk for a moment about the beautiful poetry which you create. And in many cases, your poetry are these miniature masterworks. And I wonder what that kind of writing feels like versus the more expansive writing which occurs when you are in the realm of prose, for instance. Does it feel like an entirely different kind of expression, and does it also feel like it is a process that just works differently for you?
It's a totally different thing, and I've said this before, the dreadful interview I gave at WRJN, I did say one good thing at least, and that is that poets are born, they're not made. So in a sense, you're called, and you have really no choice. You can refuse, of course, but if you don't refuse, you have to go with it. And the way it works is you are really like a transmitter. You're being sent material, or you're being made available to you. And I use the Beatles as a kind of metaphor for this, because they were obviously blessed at a time when what they were doing was needed in the world. And they all but changed the civilization, if anyone has bothered to notice. And so that's how it is. You go into these spells. They occur maybe once a year, and they may last for 2 or 3 months, when you are just in a state, and you create from that state. And, you know, I only remember writing one poem my entire life. All the rest just came to me. I remember a friend of mine who was a really good poet, only wrote one book, but it was a great book. He said he just felt like he was, it was like a shortwave message is coming to him, and all he had to do was write them down. I don't think one is that kind of that free of it. I mean, you are a participant. You do have to learn your craft, and you get better and better as you go. I wrote 21 poems, books of poems, before I wrote my masterpiece, which was Letters to My Father.
Hmm.
And that is a masterpiece. Maybe not many people know it, because the subject is very difficult. It's very serious, very somber, also full of joy as well, but the joy that can only come from suffering. But that is a great work. But it took me, you know, all my life to write it. I was 60 years old when I wrote it. Hmm. So it's like that. It's a tremendous gift, and it's a tremendous responsibility, and you shoulder it as best you can, because there's an awful lot of neglect and indifference that comes with it, and no money. I made my ride money writing prose.
Hmm. Racine writer David Kurdian, he is back in town, and there is an array of very interesting events which allow you to meet him or get reacquainted and to hear him talk about and read from some of his many important works. David Kurdian tonight is at the Racine Arts Council, appearing there at 7 p.m. along with current Racine Poet Laureate Nick Ramsey. Tomorrow night, Thursday, at 5:30 p.m., David Kurdian is appearing at the Racine Heritage Museum's annual meeting, an event which, by the way, is open to the public. Again, that is at 5:30. Friday afternoon, between 2 and 4, he is giving a talk and readings at the Racine Public Library. Saturday morning, he is appearing at Beth Israel Sinai Congregation at 9:30. And then at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he is going to be participating in a special dedication ceremony in Racine's Island Park. Several plaques containing Kurdian's poems are going to be placed near the park's beautiful pedestrian bridges. And Kurdian will be conducting readings, the event in recognition of the work of Jens Jensen, the renowned landscape architect who designed Island Park and similar spaces throughout the Midwest. Again, that event is going to be happening in Racine's Island Park between 2 and 3 o'clock this Saturday afternoon. Tomorrow on the morning show, local psychologist Lisa Abbott, who has written a book about her experience as a psychologist who herself has grappled with mental illness. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite the potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Cloudy and cool today, a high of 52 degrees. Cloudy and chilly overnight, our low drops down to 40. But tomorrow will be sunny and warmer. Tomorrow's high, 73 degrees. Sunshine expected on both Friday and Saturday as well. Seasonal highs somewhere in the mid to upper 60s. Rain possible on Sunday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.